In this week's podcast, Grizzle was joined by Warren Pies, the co-founder and strategist at 314 Research, to help us make sense of both the equity and commodity markets and why he believes we're in the midst of a bear market rally.
Thank you, everyone, for joining Grizzle's Friday Market Spaces. Our special guest today, as you know, is Warren Pies. He is the co-founder and strategist at 314 Research. They're an investment research firm with a macro quant lens on the market. But a lot of you may also know him as a veteran in the commodity space. Previously, he led Ned Davis's Research's energy and commodity strategy. So, Warren, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Excited to talk to you all about, markets, stocks, oil, and the economy, how everything ties together.
And so I want to ask you about 314's research framework. But first, before I get into that, just starting off for maybe those that don't know you, what's your background and how did you get into the business?
Yeah, I have a pretty, I'd say, unconventional background. So I was an attorney many years ago, and really was into markets, monitoring markets, and had a good friend and contact I had made through my law practice, who was a hedge fund manager in St. Petersburg, Florida, at Matador Capital. And I'm still good friends with him to this day. And I basically took him out to lunch one day and said, I want to switch careers. I don't care. I'll start from the bottom if I have to. But I really don't want to do this law thing anymore. I just want to, try and follow markets and spend 100% of my time doing that. And he had connections to Raymond James. And then he also knew a guy at Ned Davis. I said, look, this is right in my backyard. I liked the way Ned Davis approaches markets from kind of a data-driven perspective. And so I kind of got my foot in the door there, and really I had to nag the commodity strategist at NDR, Ned Davis, for a bit to even let me get an interview. And so once I did, it was like one of those things where I had to make the most of it. Again, start at the bottom as just a commodity analyst over at NDR. That was 12 years ago now. And then basically the way – my career took off as part of the commodity team. They needed someone to cover energy. So I just kind of went into a deep dive mode of energy. I broke the sector up into parts and then kind of studied each part and then just started testing and creating my own models for crude oil, for energy. I started with downstream coverage, then folded in midstream and did some upstream finally. By the In 2013, I wrote the first piece of research for Master Limited Partnerships at NDR, and that was picked up by Barron's. They loved the piece. They had me come do the Barron's Roundtable, and that was like a really good shot in the arm for getting out there and doing more strategy work and less behind-the-scenes stuff. And so that was really the start. Very fortunate and lucky in many ways to get the opportunities that I did. And be able to take this unconventional path. So just very grateful for the opportunity to have people actually pay attention to me. Whenever I get busy, you're stressed out. So I tell myself pressure is a privilege. And so that's where I started. And then by the end of the time I was at NDR, I was the head of the whole commodities team there, and decided in 2020, basically got sideways with NDR and the management there. The company changed a lot. And basically decided it was time to start my own shop. And so broke off with a couple other individuals who were NDR employees, researchers, and started 314. And I just think we can do it better. So I like the fact that NDR, started way back in 1980 by Ned Davis himself. And Ned's now retired. And he's a good guy and visionary in the space. Their whole concept was to do, everything had to be backed up by data. Whether if you make a statement, be able to back it up, have a test, have a back test. And I just like that because, there's so many just open-ended statements in markets. I like the idea that you have to, prove yourself a little bit. And so I think there are ways to do it better than what they do. I like that philosophy. So we wanted to do kind of the new version of that approach to markets. And, having a background and now a fundamental understanding of the oil and gas space, it allows for, you know, it's a really good fit to rope commodities into our asset allocation model. In this world, you have to have a view on oil to understand macro appropriately, in my view. So it's been, the backdrop's worked. Everything's kind of, all the stars have aligned for us. You know, I'm proud of the work that the team is doing, and we've gotten good traction since 2020. It's been a great ride. So that's kind of the 5-minute elevator pitch of how I started in the business and where I'm at now.
And
hey, Warren, that's Margo, if I can just ask Warren a question. Sure. You know, the first time I saw Ned Davis research, I'm like, this was wild, right? And you know, I'd seen your work at that time, and it just, the intersection of quant and fundamentals. I just, you know, obviously I didn't realize this background, your law background, and the grind set mode you had to take to get where you are right now. Maybe you can talk a little bit about, like, you know, you guys have a chief data scientist, like just how you guys, you know, how you guys merge those two worlds. Obviously a unique take.
Yeah. So that I told a story back on a podcast last year. And so it's one of those things where I don't know how people take it, but it's the honest truth. And I mean, it's just the story for me, which is, in order to do the type of analysis that we do, you have to build code. And NDR knew that. That was one of the things I'm grateful for with Ned Davis, is they, you know, the guy who hired me said, look, I like you. I like how you look at things, but the truth is you're going to need to be able to code if you're going to be successful here, and if you want to do the analysis that we do. So a big part of the hiring process there was to do this LPAT test, the language programming aptitude test. And I had never coded before that as an attorney. You know, you're just basically it's all verbal reading, writing, whatnot. And so I got pretty nervous in that interview process. I was like, you know, I can't let this stupid test trip me up and stop me from getting into this company. So I actually went and posed as a consultant and approached it. And it was a very guarded test. Like, I couldn't figure out anything about it. So I went and posed as a consultant and wrote an email to the test company and got the test in advance. And then was able to look at the questions and figure out the answers. And that was kind of like the little kind of strange thing I had to do just to get my foot in the door at NDR. And then from there, though, I had to really learn how to code. And that's the really central part, is being able to manipulate data through code is, you know, the foundation of what we do. And that was what I did for 10 years. And that was allowed me to accelerate. You know, all the questions I had coming into NDR, I was able to take and answer those and play with data, manipulate data. It was a great place to learn. And then our data scientist at 314, Fernando, I worked with him initially at NDR, but he left. He got his master's degree in machine learning at Georgia Tech and then moved out to Silicon Valley and was doing data science for a big tech company out in Silicon Valley. But when I started 314, I mean, Fernando was a good friend of mine, and we stayed in contact all these years. He was my first draft pick because I can code, I can create charts and studies and backtests, but not like this guy. I mean, there are levels to this game, and Fernando's on another level. I don't think there's anybody that can do it better than him. And so, you know what, he is like my right-hand guy. He's very much involved in the strategy work. And anytime we have a really intense model or we do custom models for certain institutional clients, he takes that side of it. So that's the first thing. How do you marry all this together? Is you got to be able to manipulate data and code. And then once you start doing that, your educational process, it gets turbocharged, and you're able to see a lot of the BS that's out in the market. You know, and if you go through Twitter, if you didn't have the ability to answer these questions, it'd be real confusing because there's so much BS out on Twitter, out in the world. And so to me, that's the real key, is being able to do the analysis yourself. You know, even if you don't have the educational background like myself, you can teach yourself. There's plenty of ways to learn. And that's the foundation to basically everything we do. You know, anything we write, any questions we explore, we ultimately have to answer it through data.
And
That has to be arguably the best story I've ever heard about Grindset getting into Quant full stop, man. That's and you know what, you pinned yourself in a corner and you had to make it happen, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really just I made that decision. Like I just made it. I mean, I even created like my own report, which was, I remember it was so stupid, but you know, I wrote a report about the spread between Brent and WTI and why it was happening. And I sent that to the guy. I was like trying to do everything I could just to get them to say, okay, we'll let this guy in the door. Cause I had nothing that they were looking for a conventional employee. And the guy had, I think he interviewed like 50 PhDs and he ended up taking me. So it was just a really, yeah. Yeah. I couldn't let any of that stuff stop me. So yeah, I had to do what I had to do.
And so you're really known for, or 314 is really known for having that macro quant lens on the market, you know, focused on numbers, not letting emotions dictate your view on the market. I believe we even had someone call you a dispassionate energy analyst. But I wanted to move on and talk about your views on the market. I pinned 314's latest research report, which is called Faith versus Fundamentals, where you kind of break down the key question facing the market, which is, are we in a bear market rally or is this a new bull market? You're skeptical that the bottom is in. Why is that?
Yeah, I think that's the ultimate question. If you're a bull right now, you're basically making the case that the lows were October. This is, you know, the ultimately the start of a new bull market. And there have been technical signals that I think are being used by the bulls to, you know, prove their case. But outside of technicals, we can back off and say, okay, it's been over six months now since October lows, and ask ourselves a very simple question. Does this look like a typical post-bottom environment? And it absolutely doesn't. There's nothing in this environment that looks like a bottom. And the number one thing we go through, and we crunch a lot of different data and get into different rabbit holes. And the thing I always come back to that's convincing to me is the Fed cycle. The Fed cycle is basically how you can break down, you know, Fed's hike phase, pause phase, cut phase, when it happens, what the economic backdrop is, and what asset prices do during each one of those phases. And the stat that sticks out in my mind is that the stock market has never set a major bottom during the hike phase of a Fed cycle. So the Fed's in the middle of hiking and the stock market bottoms. It just does not happen. And obviously, if you were saying October is the low, then that's basically making the case that we have made a bottom during the hike phase of a Fed cycle for the first time. The typical pattern is stocks are, you know, kind of grind up and down during a hike phase to have a relief rally during a pause, and the economy starts to fall apart. And that's what the Fed is always behind the curve, and they start cutting into a weakening economy. I think the same thing's going to happen now. And so I think weakness, the economic weakness, is still ahead of us. We can talk about when that's going to be and like our thoughts on that. But the bottom line is, this is not where we're at in a hike cycle, is, or the Fed cycle is not where you would expect to be if the market bottoms. So that's number one. Number two, you can look at earnings and ask the same question. Does this look like earnings following a big market low? And it doesn't. No. We have a chart, I've put it on Twitter. It's really, I think, central to our, you know, when, if we're going to be wrong, how we're going to be wrong is earnings will start hooking higher. Typically, you get 2 to 4 months off of a market low, forward earnings stabilize, and then start V-shape higher. That's obviously not happening. You're still seeing forward earnings estimates grind lower. They've kind of flattened out, but they're still making new lows. There's no evidence that earnings are starting to stabilize yet, that forward earnings are stabilizing. And this is even worse if you get a little bit under the surface. So if you break out the S&P 100, which is just mega cap stocks, and then you go to the S&P 400 and the S&P 600, so you're looking at mega cap stocks, mid cap stocks, small cap stocks, the earnings declines are worse for small cap stocks, and then subsequently just a little bit better, but still falling for mid caps, and then a little bit better, but still falling for the mega cap. So across cap structure, cap size, you're seeing the same pattern where earnings have not bottomed like you would expect following a the 6 months following a market low. So that's number two, if I'm just giving you the broad strokes here. Finally, the yield curve shape. Everyone wants to talk about the yield curve. It's a recession predictor. I mean, if you do those studies, the honest truth is the yield curve is signaling something, but the lag between inversion and an actual recession, it varies from cycle to cycle, and it's so long that it's really difficult for me to say that's a real signal of anything. What I can say is this, though, which I think is a much better way to look at the yield curve, is 6 months following a major market low, the yield curve has never been inverted. It's still inverted today. So the reason for that goes back to that Fed cycle that we're talking about. The typical market pattern is that you have the Fed hikes to cool off inflation, the Fed pauses, the market has a relief rally during the pause, and then the economy does start to roll over as monetary policy works the lag. As the market starts as the economy rolls over, the Fed says, you know, oh crap, we need to cut rates. So they start cutting rates. Now we're in a cut phase. That's when stocks actually perform the worst, when the Fed is cutting rates. So once you get 6 months out from a traditional market low, the yield curve is no longer inverted because the Fed's cut rates and restored some a positive slope to the yield curve. And so here we are 6 months post the lows, and you're still inverted on the 210 on a 210 yield curve basis. And obviously this gets worse if we take the 3 month or the 1 month or whatever you want to look at versus the 10 year. The bottom line is the yield curve doesn't look like it should at a major market low. Those are the three big things. There's other things that we've looked at. It's, you know, the returns off the bottom have been really tepid. You know, this would be the worst improvement or worst rally off of a low historically. And so that's another factor. But the really three big things I would point out is the Fed cycle. We're not in the right spot of the Fed cycle to expect October to be the low. Earnings have not behaved as they would following a major market low. They continue to make new lows on a forward basis. And then the yield curve remains inverted. So those three factors tell me, from a very just looking at the data perspective, this doesn't smell like a bottom. I don't think it will be. The recession is still ahead of us, and we can get into when we think that's going to happen. And so, yeah, I expect new lows. That's the lesson of history.
Yeah, let's maybe touch on that. When we know that the bottom isn't in, but when will we start to see a bottom? Like, is that dependent on when a recession will arrive, and when do you see that recession?
I think that the bottom, so we need to be open-minded. This is a weird cycle. So how would I know I'm wrong? Like, let's say we get, because there are a lot of folks out there, and I think there's some evidence that the economy, the core of the economy, is pretty resilient. I'm not in this no landing camp. I don't think that's possible. It's relative to where I started the year, I'd say we're more in the higher for longer camp than we were initially, because the core of the economy is its strength has surprised me. So how would I know I'm wrong? Is if we had some kind of late cycle reacceleration where earnings actually started to hook higher, forward earnings, then I would have to reexamine the premises that I laid out here, that maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the cycle is so weird and the COVID skew has changed the pattern that you would expect typically. That's not my base case, but I'm open to it, and I'm open to changing my mind. I really don't get married to these views. It's just wherever the data goes. And that's how I think I'd be wrong, is if we see earnings going higher. Now, where do I think the ultimate low goes? We've laid out this market script, and I do think that it's a really useful tool to start putting a frame around how things should work. And I think we'll follow it. I do. I think that the most likely timing for a market low is a couple months after recession starts. So I think we'll have, you know, Fed will hike however many more times they're going to hike. We'll have a pause. The pause is probably going to be, you know, 4 to 6 months, and the recession will probably land somewhere in that, you know, later part of this year. As the recession hits, you know, everything starts rolling over, earnings start rolling over again, and the decline in earnings starts picking up its pace. And at that point, obviously, I think the market starts to really get under stress. And so that's the timing of a low. It's usually about 2 months after a recession starts. And if you think the recession is going to be in the later part of this year, then, you know, that's when I think equity should start getting having more downside pressure.
Warren, just on great points here. Maybe just a question with respect to, I don't know if you saw that Jerome Powell prank call from Zelensky, but it underscores what you're saying. You know, he just said he doesn't know of any painless way, i.e. continuing hiking rates to bring down inflation. I don't know whether that flesh, you know, stating the obvious, but I know you've commented on the fact that the market's kind of waiting for this pause moment. But from that video, it was clear that he, you know, this, it wasn't on his timetable.
Yeah, I think that the Fed is always a political animal. Everyone wants to say, you know, they're data dependent, blah, blah, blah. You know, and I'm not a really Fed basher. I think there's too many people who just want to bash the Fed just because that's, you know, maybe part of their shtick and how they sell subscriptions or something. It doesn't. I just think the Fed is, the reality is they're political, and they respond to market stress, really. And so, right now the market keeps rallying, and by definition, financial conditions are easing as the market rallies. I think that, you know, that's in the back of Powell's mind. He'll probably never say that, but it's in the back of his mind. And if you study history, the Fed doesn't pause when the market's just shooting to new highs. There's usually a short-term period of weakness, 5-10% correction, that comes at the end of a hike cycle and, you know, leads into a pause. So I'm doubtful, they're not going to pause here in May. What will happen in June? I kind of think it's going to be dictated by the market. Everyone's going to say, well, let's watch. I think CPI is going to actually be a little tough the next two readings for the April and May data. It's when you start looking at what's happening under the hood with cars and shelter inflation. I think that inflation is going to prove to be sticky for another 3-4 months here. And so I don't think inflation is going to give them cover to pause. But if the market were to, you know, lose, if the S&P drops 300 points, say it gets back down to 3,800, now the Fed's feeling a little more comfortable pausing at that point. But if the market takes off from here, goes to 4,300, they probably keep hiking. That's how I see it. And I understand the data and what we're supposed to say, but I think the Fed watches the market because the market dictates, you know, how people's, the favorability rating for politicians, and the Fed's a political animal.
Hey, Warren, could I ask you a quick question as you think of what's priced into the market? Because I look at the forward estimates of Fed funds, and they're, you know, the market is expecting cuts pretty soon. Is it not actually the way you should look at it, that the market thinks the Fed's going to be cutting in a month or two? It's really, what if it's pricing in flat rates where we are, or another hike for a while, then a big cut? Like, how do you think of when you look at what the forward curve looks like? Like, what is it telling you? Is it something different than just cuts in 2 months?
Yeah, I think I take it in at somewhat face value, but this isn't really a predictive tool from what I've seen. And so, you know, if you think about a recession, you would expect, what is it, 200 basis points of cuts are priced in? Is that right?
That's somewhere in there.
Okay, so I think that would be light for your typical recessionary cut phase. And so the market is, I think, more or less weighing the probability that we actually start having a recession this year, is how I look at it. And the path is less important than what the signal. And the signal to me is that, you know, the odds are better than 50% that we have the recession starts this year, according to futures market. And so that's how I look at that.
It's interesting. Thanks.
I wanted to pin a tweet that you said yesterday. You said this cycle, it feels like the pause is always one hike away. Wondering how this impacts the pause postscript. Is that kind of you saying, like, you know, equities are kind of front running this pause, like it's kind of already priced in, or what did you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, that is what when we wrote our outlook for 2023. It just sounds kind of like, I don't know, too fancy or whatever, but like we said that the theme for 2023 will be reflexivity. And the idea, reflexivity, the idea is that the market is constantly making predictions about the future and the things it predicts don't happen exactly because it predicts them. And it's an old Soros kind of line of logic. And that's, I think, playing out, like, where everyone's expecting a recession. So then you have reactions to the expectation of a recession that might stave off a recession. You have the market front running a pause, which might stop the Fed from pausing. All of these, and we outlined a whole bunch of these things in our outlook and have updated them through the year. And I think it has held true that reflexivity is a very powerful force in the markets. And so to me, the way that works with the Fed is that as the market is, okay, we're going to pause. So the relief rally, and that was some of the chatter yesterday, was that the market was rallying off of that kind of fake Zelensky video where Powell alluded to, you know, one more hike, then we're done. So now the market rallies as if it was, you know, we're going to front run the pause. Well, if the market rallies too much, going back to what I said, you could very well have the Fed hiking again in June. So it's just kind of like market strength leads to another hike, pushes the pause that we're rallying because of off. And that's what I mean. And then if the Fed does pause and the market had rallied and pulled forward all that pause, quote unquote, performance, then I have to wonder if you're really going to get the same pause rally that history says you get. Because there have been times where the Fed's paused and the market continues to go down. Most obvious would be 2000. That was the case where the Fed paused and the market just continued to go lower. And if my memory serves me correctly, the market did kind of rally into the pause that case as well. I might have that wrong, but I think I'm right. And the other factor is that's the only time the market's been more overvalued than it is right now. And so similarities, we've pointed to that cycle, that post previous tech bubble cycle, as a real good analog for the market here numerous times. And so that's in my mind, is that if the Fed, if we front run that pause rally, it makes the likelihood of a subsequent true pause rally less likely.
Hey, Warren, do you have a view on what the catalyst could be that would stop any type of grind higher? Because so far, you know, we've seen earnings falling. So the PE of the market continues to go up and the Fed is hiking, but stocks have still been going up. Like, if we think the recession's not, you know, 6 months out or whatever it is, could we continue to grind higher? And what would stop that? Is it something breaks in the market?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. I think that's a good point, that you need to identify a catalyst here if you're going to kind of take a bearish posture, because the market's been grinding higher. We're close to the highs of the year, which would mean that this is the longest, if we are in a bear market rally, this would be the longest bear market rally on record for the S&P 500. So that's worth noting against all the kind of facts that I laid out for why I don't think this is a bottom. Is it, if this is just a bear market rally, it's a very long one. So you have to start thinking, where could you be wrong, or what would be why would the market sell off and do what you expect it to do? The first place I would look is that we've had rates really back up. If we can go back and remember the beginning of this year and how this year's gone, we come into the year, everybody expected a recession. That was like recession immediately. I remember doing some big podcasts at the very end of the year saying, we think second half recession, and everybody was kind of skeptical. I got a lot of pushback. I mean, how could you think the economy is not going to go into a recession immediately? The number of forecasters predicting a recession off the charts. That was entering 2023. Then we all transitioned to, hey, maybe we could have a soft landing. You know, there's, you know, maybe that's ahead of us, and had a market rally on that. Then we had the whole no landing. We transitioned to, oh, the market's just going to reaccelerate. We got the January data. And then March gave us the banking crisis, the banking stress. So I kind of seen the leaders in the market have been these big tech stocks. And that's well documented. It's like 8 or 10 stocks have really delivered almost all of the gains for the S&P 500 this year. The breadth has been horrible. But when you have like Microsoft and Meta and Google and Amazon, these stocks, Nvidia, going up, you know, 75-80% in a few months, then, you know, that can do a lot of to power the index. So why are those stocks higher? First, it's the AI thing, which I don't know how you stop that. You know, that's, it's kind of a mania. But the second factor has been rates. You know, we have seen the 2-year rate go from 5 to sub 4 in, 45 days, basically, off the back of this banking crisis. And I think that lends support to these kind of long duration safety trade stocks that are all way overvalued at this point. But everybody has a muscle memory of just going into these few stocks that they know are safe from the COVID era and things like that. And so what would potentially bring those down? I think if the market started to take higher for longer more seriously and rates started to get priced out higher, and the banking crisis was kind of, we decided collectively that the banking crisis was more or less over, the Fed would be responsive to any future failures. Rates rising, discount rates rise, that pushes valuations, relative valuations for these big tech stocks up even more. That could be one catalyst. A way we get there, I think, is through some negative CPI reports. I think that the next two CPI reports are real danger zones for the market. And so that would go through, that would, the effects of those negative inflation reports would go through the rates market first and then ultimately to the equity market in this scenario. So that's a downside catalyst, debt ceiling and things like that. Another potential downside catalyst, and, smart people that I talk to do think there's some other, we're not done with all the credit issues yet. And so there's, it's just a matter of when. It's just, I think there's no escaping it. If we keep rates here, that there's going to be some real credit issues. It's just a matter of when they happen and how the Fed and Congress reacts.
Warren, maybe just a corollary on that. Just to support your point, right? If it was just AI for, say, these big tech stocks, and you're entering a new paradigm of unbelievable returns and new productivity, that'd be one thing. But at the same time, we've also seen Bitcoin rallying the same amount as Facebook.
Actually, great point. I mean, Bitcoin I think it is an opportunity cost, low rate, long duration, whatever you want to call it, basket that's leading this market, tech stocks, big tech stocks especially. And so to me, that's just like last year was less about an earnings contraction and more about, a re-rating of multiples to adjust the world to, rapidly rising interest rates. We've had interest rates ease this year. And I think that's a catalyst. And there is, back in the day, the safety trade was rates come down, you go into bonds, and then in the markets, you go into utilities and staples and healthcare. And these days, I think that the safety trade, a more attractive safety trade, is to go into these big cap tech stocks.
Warren, I want to ask you now, shift from equities over to commodities. I know a lot of people are here to get your take on oil. How do you see oil playing out this year, given we may get a recession in the back half of this year? Because I know the bulls are kind of playing on this theme that OPEC cuts will take place next month. Refiners are gearing up for driving season. But then obviously this recession is looming. How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, I think in the biggest, so our model is very bullish right now on crude oil. It hasn't been for quite a while. It was long oil exposure all through the beginning of last year and into late summer, and then moved to neutral, and has just recently, actually right before the OPEC cut announcement, was a fortuitous signal. The model flipped to a buy, and we published all this. We're doing a Substack right now, the Energy Cable, where we update the model and some of our quick thoughts on oil. It's not quite what we give to institutional clients, but it's, if you want to get a little flavor of how we look at the world, you can sign up for that. It's a much cheaper option. But in any event, that's been our timing, is the model flipped there, and the read has been, the early part of the year, the thing that held the model back were inventories. So inventories were, we had the worst start like 2 month start to a year that we've ever had for total petroleum inventories, which is the basis we look at for the United States weekly data. And, you know, really the only periods where you saw oil build as much were during the GFC and COVID. And so really the first part of this year, we built as if we were in a recession. A lot of people scratching their heads because the, you know, physical market didn't look that bad. China coming back from lockdown, all this stuff. And so really, I think the explanation for the early year sloppiness in inventories is more of just a very high degree of refinery maintenance. So refineries were offline, which caused runs to get cut and oil to basically back up into inventories. Now, I wrote a whole thread on this and talked about this plenty of times. That if the background was super bullish, you would have expected to see better draws from refined products at that point in time. We didn't really get that, but it wasn't like the end of the world either. It wasn't as bad as the numbers suggested early on. And so from March on, really the last 6 weeks, we've had very strong inventory reports that have, you know, coincided obviously with the OPEC announcement. Before the OPEC Plus announcement, Russia had already announced they were cutting their production. And so from my, all this is to say, from our model's perspective and from my perspective, the market looks very healthy right now. That, yeah, the balances aren't great, but all the momentum is in balances, means that it's not like you have a huge deficit in the market at this very moment for crude oil. But when you look ahead a little bit, if OPEC follows through even a little bit on these cuts, I would expect to see, and at the same time, China demand is picking up. So, and the final leg to this is that, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, is that U.S. is not at risk of going into an imminent recession, in my view. So those three things create, when you look forward, a very strong backdrop for crude oil as we go into May and definitely into June and second half of the year. So I think it's a very bullish backdrop. Now, the question everybody has is why then, after this OPEC announcement, did we only get up to, you know, why did we get such a measly bump and then we're already back down to where we were at the point where OPEC made the announcement? And I think it all comes down to these macro fears, because the actual oil data, no, there hasn't been anything in the inventory data. There hasn't been anything out of China. When you look across different kind of arcane indicators that we monitor, there isn't anything troubling that should have seen oil sell off the way it did a couple days ago. And I think the factors are, number one, technical. You know, markets have a tendency to close, quote unquote, fill the gap. So we had a gap in the charts from the OPEC announcement that's now been filled. So it acts like a magnet. Markets just want to fill the gap and become support, or potentially you could break down. I think it will be support. So that's number one. But I think most importantly is everyone's kind of trading oil on this macro fear. It's getting lumped into the macro fear trade. The idea that we're entering a recession, you know, banking stress, all of that stuff. And so the algos are selling oil to as part of that basket of trade. So the real question, the real pushback at this moment to me is, you know, is the U.S. about to slip into a recession? Why would I want to own oil if the U.S. is about to slip into recession? So that's where I think ultimately we should go with the conversation. If you want to know about why we have a positive outlook for oil for the next 6 months.
Warren, that was my exact question, because I struggle with that as an energy investor. You know, if all the fundamentals look amazing, but we get a recession, can it really be that tight that it can, you know, the stocks can outperform other sectors at the least? We'd love to get, if you want to expand on that, we'd love to hear.
Yeah, probably not if we got a recession. So yeah, you don't, there is now, you to be clear, like, you, if we get a bad recession, yeah, energy and oil is, there's going to be a soft spot for it. But if you study the path of oil along official recessions, NBER defined recessions, it's not like oil just falls off a cliff once a recession starts either. So with number one, there is a misconception out there that we're in a recession right now. I don't think we are. I think that the economy actually had a mini reacceleration earlier this year. There's an argument that can be made that, you know, lending standards are ratcheting up and the bank stress is yet to work totally through. I'm open-minded to that. But when we center ourselves on whether we're going to have a recession or when the recession is going to be, we go back to the housing industry and construction payrolls, particularly construction payrolls lead total non-farm payrolls by about 4 to 6 months. It is a leading indicator. I mean, the housing market, there is kind of the economy in the United States. And in order to have a recession, it's really difficult to have a true recession and have housing and construction booming. And it's booming right now still. We just saw the first month-over-month slight decline in construction and payrolls here recently. It traditionally, you don't get a recession until you see construction payrolls decline 8 to 10%. And we've done, you know, a lot of analysis on this, and I believe I've tweeted some of this out, or 314 has tweeted some of this out, some of that work. But yes, you need to see construction payrolls decline. When you go back and then you get really under the covers, okay, so payrolls in construction is really a function of number of units being built, number of housing units, total multifamily, single family houses being built. That's still at basically an all-time high, houses under construction, units under construction. Starts are falling now. Single family starts and multifamily are starting to crack. But the total number of units under construction is still at close to an all-time high. And that's because we have this pandemic. It took the pandemic, by our estimate, pushed the time it takes to build a house out by, I think, 5 months or so. So you have a huge backlog of houses that are being constructed right now, and starts are falling, but it's not like they're falling off a cliff either. And so you still have a decent amount of workload for the housing or the construction industry. And it's difficult to get a recession starting with that kind of backlog of houses under construction. You need to work through that. According to our analysis, you basically have, you can wrap a cone around, say, September through January of 2024 as when we would get to that 8 to 10% reduction in construction payrolls. And that would be, we've made a number of assumptions on, you know, starts and time it takes to finish a home and things like that. We've gotten all, into all that, modeled it out. The bottom line is, and I think this is way too precise, but everyone's got to have, you know, have a prediction. The precise prediction would be a recession starts somewhere in November. And there's a bunch of factors in my view that actually, if I was forced to take an over or under on that, I would probably take the over, because there are a number of factors that are extending the cycle and have continued to extend the cycle out. So when you put that on the chessboard, you say recession probably starts in Q4, let's call it November of Q4 of this year. You now have, you know, 6 to 7 months before that recession starts, where you should have a nice clear runway for oil, where China's coming back fully into the market, where OPEC cuts are going to have time to work through the system. We'll have meaningful draws, and the U.S. is still going to be growing in growth mode. I mean, up until that spot. And if you go through history, you generally don't get a recession also without a spike in oil prices. So it's not necessary, but this was something I tweeted yesterday too, is you typically expect at the very end of a cycle, a late cycle surge in the price of oil. You saw it in the 2008 period. We've seen it a number of times at the end of cycles, where oil kind of helps tip the economy into recession. And it's, again, it's hard to have a recession when you're getting this kind of tailwind to consumers, where oil price goes from 140 to 80 year over year. That's a pretty big tailwind to consumers. So,
Warren, I just ask a question in terms of what's the analog here between the 70s and have you given it a lot of thought that, you know, oil could remain high through a recession? And the like. I just wanted to get your thoughts on just how you see this cycle for oil fundamentally different than, say, the past more recent ones.
The most I was kind of pushing back against the 70s comparisons until the Russia-Ukraine conflict. At that point, you know, the 70s were littered with these geopolitical oil disruptions to oil which helped create stagflation. It's really hard to get stagflation without some kind of oil crisis, right? And so I was pushing back against that 70 stagflation view until we got into that conflict. So that conflict kind of opens the door. You never know what it's Russian production has been resilient. Who knows where it goes? I don't really know where it's going to go in the future. I mean, the history of the history tells us that we should expect production to decline, but when that happens again, it's a fuzzy thing to answer. So that would be the closest I can get us to 70, is that this kind of access, kind of that the analog that gets us into stagflation. But that would be the only way. You need major supply disruptions that we don't have right now to tip the economy into recession and keep oil prices high, which is really what you're looking for if you want to end up where we were in the 70s. I think a recession brings oil prices down eventually this time. I mean, OPEC, there's spare capacity there, and they're, you know, these cuts actually build their spare capacity. And so, you know, I think they would put a floor under the price of oil. If a recession happened, you'd have a sell-off and, you know, go into another cycle, basically. So no, I don't think it's, at this point, it's not the bottom line is I don't see this being quite like the 70s.
Thank you.
And so we have about 10 more minutes left with Warren before the spaces ends. I want to open up the floor to any questions. I know the Crude Chronicles has requested to come up. Do you have a question?
Yeah, sure thing. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Hey, Warren, what's up, man? Hope all is well. I think you sort of answered this just in your last answer. But, you know, just if you weren't bullish on oil, sort of looking at it here, and, you know, we talked about oil being sort of that late cycle that tips the economy in a recession. I guess my question is, like, have you ever seen, just in the data or the charts, because I can't really recall one myself, where you had sort of sticky inflation, and, you know, you've pointed out how you've seen some of the underlying components and how they can be are going to remain sticky here, but not have oil coupled with CPI, sort of like this divergence between oil and everything else?
No, it's really difficult to get historically to have CPI remain sticky or high with oil falling. So that's why, you know, there is going to be kind of this disinflationary headline impact as we go through this year, especially as we go through, we lap the comps from last year where we had the massive spike through the summer. So that's going to be a big tailwind to CPI. I don't think that's one thing where I don't think the Fed's going to overreact to that, and they shouldn't really, because even if oil rallies back to like 100 or so, which is kind of what I expect, you're still getting year over year negative prints. So it's going to be deflationary. So to me, that's the one positive thing for headline CPI. But, you know, our view is that housing and shelter inflation, the way it works out, whether you want to argue with the methodology or whatever, but the way it works out is I think we exit the year, everything else could be flat, and we still have 3% core CPI just based off shelter inflation. So oil would have to do a whole lot of work to negate that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, man.
Appreciate it.
Does anyone else have any questions for Warren? Tracy, do you have any questions?
No, I follow Warren pretty closely. I don't have any questions at this point.
No worries. Maybe I'll just ask one. So I know that you talked about this just in your tweet, but you were like, oil is the ultimate late cycle asset. Usually a price surge helps to tip the economy into a recession. This cycle, we see a Q4 recession, plenty of time for oil to bounce and help squeeze the consumer in the interim. I know you talked about that previously, but is this like, you really have to know how to time this market, because these spikes are just very drastic and like it tips off very shortly after, or what's kind of your outlook on investors timing this market? Like, is caution warranted because it's so cyclical? Or
yeah, I think we're not. Well, the factors are we're months away from a recession starting, in my view. Even in the earliest of our scenarios, we're months away. And if you look at it, it actually, because if you think about recessions get dated way off into the future. So we weren't going to know, their NBER is not going to declare a recession until, you know, way in the future. So if you think about, just think about the 2008 cycle. We entered recession at the very end of 07. Oil made new all-time highs that we never even got back to, I don't believe, in July of 2008. So technically 7 months into the recession, oil's, you know, shooting higher. You can go back and find similar examples where, you know, the economists can pin the start of recession. And that's what we're really trying to do with our analysis is when are, because if you do any kind of what does the stock market do, what does earnings do, you have to kind of get into the shoes of the NBER economist. And so that's what we're doing. But at the same time, it's a little bit of a myth to think that as soon as they, you know, paint the line on the chart for a recession, that oil just falls off a cliff. It doesn't happen like that. And so we have months before the recession starts, and it can often be months into the recession before oil falls apart. Especially if you know, let's say post these, if OPEC falls through, if OPEC and Russia follow through on all their cuts, China is actually growing demand, and we could end up with a well over a million barrel a day deficit moving into the in the next few months. And so, you know, the early stages of a recession aren't going to just, you know, we're not just going to start building inventories and having refiners cut runs and everything else that you see in the middle of a recession. You would see some strength into that recession still for oil, which is probably why, you know, the typical pattern is that kind of high oil prices don't fit the economy and help push it further into contraction.
Thank you, Warren, and for that clarification. And yes, hyperbolic discounter, please go ahead. I know you've been waiting.
Yeah, thank you, Margo. Warren, I had a question for you as a long-term oil investor myself. You know, one of the issues I focus on is how resolute OPEC Plus is in defending an oil price floor to maintain their fiscal break-even levels. Is that something that you incorporate in your analysis? I mean, we saw, what was it, a month ago, we saw that reduction that you just referred to. You know, how resolute do you think they are in maintaining a price floor to achieve their respective fiscal break-evens? Thank you.
Yeah, good question. I used to break the Saudi budget down every year and determine the fiscal break-evens. I don't know. I haven't done it here for a little bit, but it, you know, it's obviously, you always come out somewhere around 90 to 100 bucks a barrel, and that obviously the reason you do this is try and make the point that, you know, lifting costs are different than fiscal break evens, and that those things get confused a lot when you're talking to more generalist investors. And so, but the point is that, yeah, we're not really, my best guess without having crunched the actual numbers this year, but the fiscal break even is probably close to 90 bucks a barrel for Saudis. And, you know, you can't just sit there. They definitely want to make up. They have a lot of ambitious programs over there and infrastructure build outs that they're doing. And those projects need to be funded with higher oil prices. So I kind of do think that this is a more serious OPEC this time around. And it's, you know, Javier Blas wrote a really nice article last few days talking about the transition of shale. And one of the points he makes in that article, which I think is exactly right, is that OPEC used to fear the shale industry, that if they were to, you know, cut production and, you know, try and target prices more, versus market share, that you would have this massive surge in shale activity that would come back online and steal share back from them. They worked so hard to recapture post 2014. And I don't think we're in that regime anymore. You know, and that's probably for anyone who's like an energy insider here, that's probably a no dust statement, but for the generalists, things have changed. Shale's not just going to roar back. The, you know, investors, they all want dividends and buybacks and capital discipline. So I think this is the time where OPEC has played the long game. They've kind of, you know, transitioned from the old days of shale into a new era. And from here now, they can start pushing prices up to where they need to be for their budgets. And that's where we're at now. So I think, I think they're targeting to get prices back to like 90 bucks a barrel. And no one in OPEC is going to lose sleep if we get to 100 either. So they might say something different, but that's how I see
it. Awesome. Thank you very much. Love your stuff.
Yeah, appreciate that.
Hey, Warren, just on that point, and maybe I don't know if you've looked at past cycles, just with respect to, I guess, one of the bullish, one of the things underpinning the bullish thesis for oil is that, you know, we just haven't seen the capex, the necessary capex to maintain production levels, and shale being a component of that. Just wanted to get your thoughts on, are we in a lower standard deviation bound of capex for the oil industry relative to the past? Like, I'm just trying to think, has this historically been a trigger, this low level of investment relative to current consumption?
Yeah. Well, the answer to that is yes, but that story has been around for a long time. We've been kind of underspending and underinvesting globally for quite a while. I remember this, if you go back, and I quoted this like 2021 in one of our reports, if you go back and read like Schlumberger's, I think it was their conference calls, and they had some presentations too. And their CEO of Schlumberger in 2017, early 2017, was worrying about decline rates and all these different problems with underinvestment. And of course, Schlumberger is talking their book. But the point is, I remember encountering that thesis all the way back in 2017, and there's truth in it. There, we are underspending. For the most part, people who are saying that, you know, that's not a timing tool. That's not how you, that's not going to tell you anything about like the next 12 months for oil, because there's plenty of oil and spare capacity right now. That's like a future catastrophe type situation. The history of oil, though, is it moves in a roughly 8-year cycle. If you look at oil or the energy sector, there's this what we call multi-year mean reverting cycle, where 8-year good years are followed typically by 8 bad years. So that's like basically the lead time for a long cycle development project. And so it makes sense. And that's how you see oil moving. That's how you see expenditures moving. Now, the difference in this cycle or this time in history is that we have the whole green revolution thing. And we had a bunch of management teams that didn't deliver returns during the last spending cycle. So you have a lot of stress on CapEx, and that absolutely will bite at some point. But like I said, we've been hearing about this for 6 years now. We could very well be hearing about it for another 2 years, 3 years before any of this underspend actually starts to show up in anything material to the market. So that's the caveat, is that, yep, we're underspending. Yes, there will be a result or impact from it. It will eventually cause prices to go higher, in my view, assuming that we're not just going to quit oil, which I don't think we are, and the demand is going down on some terminal decline. But it's far from, like, nobody really knows when that's going to hit. It's a multi-year prediction, not a, oh, this is a 2023 event.
Very helpful. Thank you. That's a great answer.
And so we're coming up on the hour here. I think we had one more audience question from Dave. Warren, do you have time to take it, or is it a hard stop at one?
Yeah, let's go with one more question.
Okay, Dave, go ahead.
Hey, Warren. My question around your model and, you know, oil price spike leading recession was around, is this specific to a U.S. recession, or talking about global? Reason I ask is because, you know, the BRICS economies, you mentioned China coming back, but India and Brazil also strong. Energy use increasing in those countries. When you look at your models, does it consider how oil prices may be more resilient versus historically with the U.S. and developed countries representing less of the oil demand story than they used to? Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. Our model is, you know, obviously oil is a global asset and it runs off of global demand. Most of the are, just to give you a quick overview of the model, we use technicals, physical market indicators, four components: technicals, physical market, positioning, which is futures positioning, and inventories. Now, the part that confuses people, I think, within the model, we have a ton of different indicators when it comes to all those different components. For physical market, we're looking at differentials all over the map and trying to work out, whether you're starting to see some kind of physical market improvement or deterioration. When it comes to inventories, we do focus primarily on weekly U.S. inventory reports, and that's because that's their cleanest, most high-frequency data source. And so that's where I think a lot of people come back, and clients over the years have said, hey, is this just – you're just looking at U.S. inventories. This isn't going to work. And my analysis, you know, I remember going through building this, and it's the whole missing barrel hypothesis that some people come up with, and like, we're, you know, IEA is understanding demand, and you go through these periods, and the bottom line is, it's an interconnected market. If you get weakness somewhere, yeah, you're gonna have you can have mismatches in inventories that take place for a little bit, but about 8 weeks is the max that we've seen, where you can have 8 weeks where, say, you're getting draws or bullish reports in the U.S. and you're building everywhere else, but eventually differentials kick in, which then pushes flows into a different direction, and arbs open up that weren't open before, and you start having inventories find the place where they're treated the best, which could be the U.S. or it could be foreign markets. The point being, all these markets are interconnected. So U.S. inventories are connected to every other, you know, major hub around the world, for the most part, in my view. You know, it's not perfect, but it's close. And the lag time between changes in U.S. inventories or in reflecting, say, strength or weakness that's taking place in some other major, you know, globally, is about 8 weeks. So if you get 8 weeks of bad inventory reports in the U.S. from our view, you can kind of write that off as this is just a U.S. specific issue. It's not something that's happening globally. But once it gets beyond 8 weeks, that's a trend. That's a global trend. From my analysis. So we're looking mainly at U.S. inventories, but that's all connected from our analysis.
That's great. Thanks.
Warren, thank you so much. You've been super generous with your time with us today. That was Warren Pies, the co-founder and strategist at 314 Research. Please make sure to go follow him and his investment research firm here on Twitter. And also feel free to give Thomas a follow, Scott Willis a follow, and obviously Tracy Shy Girl, who's always so generous to join us every week on our Twitter spaces. Thank you so much.